Welcome to episode 23 for March 6th, 2007. Today, of course, as always, a great episode, perhaps our greatest. Each one better than the one before it, so by definition, that would make this the absolute greatest. Anyway, we're going to start with one of my favorite directors today, doing a spotlight on Billy Wilder, a director with a long and diverse career in American film. We'll be talking all about his films. Sam will have a trivia question for us. We're going to have a fact or fiction, this one a little bit more morbid than the previous ones, this one on untimely deaths. Our top six will be on time travel movies, not the movies that play with time that we did previously, but conventional time travel movies, particular favorite subgenre of mine. And finally, we're going to spotlight the film Rocky, I think a movie that's been unfairly overlooked or overshadowed perhaps by some of its subpar sequels. Anyway, I'm Stephen Keller.
Yeah, and I'm Sam Stoddard. Look, I don't have much time. I just wanted to say what a great episode this was. This is a great episode. Whoa, I'm being sucked back to the future!
One of the greatest directors of all time is also one of the hardest to pin down. When you think of most great directors, you think of a very specific style. There's the term Hitchcockian that describes those elegant, well-crafted psychological thrillers that Hitchcock did. When you think of Akira Kurosawa, maybe you think of the samurai epics or a few of his personal contemporary Japanese films. A director like Ingmar Bergman, you think of sort of surrealist, philosophical films. But with the writer-director Billy Wilder, you don't get that same obvious style when you think of his name. He worked all over the map in terms of he did some of the best screwball comedies, he did one of the best film noir, and he also made a lot of movies that are sort of in between drama and comedy and noir and everything else. He worked throughout a lot of genres, and he was a great writer as well as a director, but never did he have a single easy-to-pinpoint style. Despite that, Sam and I both consider him, I think, one of our favorite directors, and that's why we're going to do a director spotlight on him. In this segment, we're going to talk about his career, some of the themes in his work and his life, and next week we're going to talk a bit more about his movies, talk a bit about our favorite Wilder films and what it is that we like about them. So to get started with, Wilder is very well respected, and an interesting thing is he's probably a little bit more respected among, say, directors than he is among critics, though definitely he's very well respected among critics and film scholars. The Sight and Sound magazine, which is the magazine of the British Film Institute, does this every decade, a top list that they ask all the greatest directors and critics to comment on, give their picks for best directors and best films of all time. And in the most recent one, Billy Wilder was on the top 10 directors list. So the greatest directors in the world, he made their top 10 list of favorite directors. And that makes sense. The writer-director Cameron Crowe has, in fact, written an entire book on Billy Wilder. It's called Conversations with Wilder. And one of the interesting things about Wilder that makes him easy for directors to love, but a little harder for critics, is that he does such variety. For instance, he did one of the definitive screwball comedies called Some Like It Hot with Marilyn Monroe and Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon. He did probably one of the most influential films noir, Double Indemnity, but also later Sunset Boulevard, which is sort of a noir. And he did lots of movies in between, including the great 1960 film The Apartment, which is both drama and comedy kind of mixed together. It stars Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine. And he's just been a huge influence to people throughout the industry. And he has an interesting biography. He was originally born Samuel Wilder in what was Austria-Hungary. That's part of what would now be Poland, and his mother gave him the nickname Billy. And he got into pictures as a screenwriter after having worked for a while as a journalist and a writer and other things, and he was working in that area. I worked with lots of other Germans who would later come over to America, and in fact, he would eventually have to flee Europe because he was Jewish, and he saw the handwriting on the walls as the Nazis started taking over Europe. He got out of there, and same thing, of course, with a lot of other European directors who fled Europe during the 30s and 40s and came to America. And so he made one film in Europe, but it's not very good. He made it as a director, so no reason to talk about that. And when he got to America before World War II, he started off as a screenwriter. One of his first big hits was the Greta Garbo picture Ninotchka. Another comedy called Ball of Fire was a big hit at that time, and started directing in America with the 1942 film The Major and the Minor, which was a hit, and by 1944 he directed the film Double Indemnity, which is just an absolute prototypical film noir, arguably it's the first real true film noir, but even if it's not, it's really close, and it set up that entire movement. He was one of the people, absolutely, which makes sense, of course. A European director working with an American cinema would be the sort of person who would really influence film noir, because it's influenced so much by European filmmaking. And in 1946, so this is just 4 years after he starts directing in America, he's won Best Director, the Oscar, for his film The Lost Weekend, which is a portrait about alcoholism and its effects on people. I think it's a little dated today, but it was at the time a really well-respected movie, won Best Picture. It, you know, seems a little bit cheesy, but especially for the time, fairly edgy psychological portrait of addiction, something that wasn't going to be tackled a whole lot at that point in time, with that much realism, even though it is a little over the top.
Yeah, and Wilder would be pushing the boundary throughout his career. He would be often at the forefront of specific movements, whatever they are. I personally love The Lost Weekend, but I will admit, virtually all his other movies do age better. And that's another remarkable thing to me about Wilder, is how timeless his movies tend to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's partially because he was constantly at the forefront of things. He wasn't ever following the trend. He was always pushing movements, and so you don't get the sense that it's just doing what was cool at the time. And he worked very steadily throughout the 1950s and the 1960s. Just, it was sort of within the Hollywood studio system, but by the 50s it was a little weaker than it had been. So he wasn't making, you know, tons and tons of movies, though he made quite a few. And he retired in the early 1980s and just didn't work again. He died in 2002 at the age of 95, but he hadn't worked in, you know, quite some time at that point. I mentioned a little bit about his styles before, but he doesn't seem to have a single discernible style. And in a sense, one of the things that he most has a style is as a writer. He worked often with collaborators, but almost every movie he directs, he's going to have at least a co-writer credit. And he wrote a bunch of movies he didn't direct. And he really, really, really appreciates snappy, sharp dialogue, even in his dramas. He worked very famously with the novelist Raymond Chandler in the film Double Indemnity, and apparently they didn't get along very well. I guess Chandler was hard to work with, but I've read...
He kept smoking that pipe that drove Wilder up the wall.
But apparently Wilder was willing to work with him just because Chandler was such a great writer, had such a great flair for dialogue, and I mean, absolutely every single one of Wilder's movies has a script that sparkles. And his visual styles as a director are very, very varied. Again, I keep going back to Double Indemnity, but it's just such an important movie, and it was vital in establishing the noir look with that stark black-and-white cinematography and the use of shadows and darks to really convey a sense of danger and evil. Really wonderful black-and-white photography throughout. I think a great example is the film The Apartment, which I love and is a well-respected movie. I get the feeling that even though it is really well-respected, it sometimes gets a little bit overshadowed by Wilder's other movies just because they're such definitive landmarks within their genres. The Apartment doesn't really fit to, you know, it's not a noir movie, it's not a screwball, it's sort of in between all these other things, but that has a wonderful, wonderful black and white look, and I think it was the last black and white film to win Best Picture until Schindler's List.
Yeah, Wilder would always work in black and white if the studios would let him, and that was the big thing, and later on it got harder and harder to convince the studios, but he made a black and white movie in 1966, The Fortune Cookie, with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau. It was the first pairing of those two. 1966, nobody was still using black and white. It's very remarkable, and yet he was still very good at color. I think of Irma Ladouce in 1963. Before Amelie painted a picture of a very colorful Paris, there was Irma Ladouce that did basically the same thing without the digital tricks and everything, but it was very colorful and vibrant, looked like a lively, exciting place to be, and that couldn't have been done in black and white. So he was proficient with cinematography either way.
Sure. Of course, I think, maybe we're talking about colorful portraits of Paris. You got to mention An American in Paris, which is a decade earlier.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But, I mean, absolutely. I mean, Wilder, and it's always neat seeing him work in Europe because he has such a European background. And he often embraced screwball. He loved to make movies that were screwball comedies or that had screwball elements. And he liked to really work within that sort of comedies of manners where you have these people who are having these weird misunderstandings. And, I mean, even the senses, it always creeps into his dramatic work, too. There's always a little sense of funniness. Even Double Indemnity, which is a really dark film, or Stalag 17, which is a POW movie about prisoners in World War II. There's also a lot of humor in that film, a lot of kind of comic lines, and he has this sort of cynical but still funny look at the world. And I think that gets lost a lot in discussions about Wilder when they talk about his sort of cynicism. The Apartment is a fairly dark movie, but there's never a sense that the world is a terrible place. Wilder seems to really enjoy life and kind of have a little bit of a joke. Yeah, okay, things are dark and you know, he liked to look at the maybe the worst side of humans, and people tend to be selfish, but, you know, even still, he wanted to look at it with a wink and a laugh.
Isn't that weird? Yeah, he was very cynical and did not believe the best would come of people. He pretty much always assumed the worst. And yet his movies are so fun and almost uplifting in a way. But it's like he's saying, yeah, the life is terrible, but hey, you know, it ain't that bad. It's still fun.
Right, I think there's a sense his heroes, generally speaking, with a few exceptions, but his heroes generally end up doing the right thing, and there's a sense that, yeah, other people will do the wrong thing, but you just suffer through it, and if you have a good sense of humor about it, you can keep it up and be the good guy. I also want to mention, when you talk about him as a writer, his wonderful, wonderful ability to write closing lines. Some Like It Hot has one of the all-time greatest closing lines, perhaps the best final line in a film. But, you know, there's a lot of other good lines he has. I think the final line of The Apartment is also an absolutely hilarious, perfect closing line and a very famous film quote, less famous than Some Like It Hot. But I don't know, there's this real sense that his dialogue is just constantly so sharp and so funny. But again, like I mentioned, it's hard to pin him down. He's one of the most varied of the great directors. I was looking at one resource on the internet. I think it was like Wikipedia or something, and they mentioned that a lot of scholars and stuff don't like to talk about Wilder too much just because he doesn't seem to exemplify the auteur theory, the theory that the director is the author of a film and has a specific style, because Wilder's films don't seem to have like a clear style. You can't watch a Wilder movie and easily tell that it's a Wilder film if you didn't know it. It's not at all, like I mentioned, like Hitchcock or Spielberg or anyone else who has a very specific style. I think once you know it's a Wilder film, you can definitely pick up on lots of themes, but it's not going to be jumping out at you. So it makes it a little difficult to talk about him in a real critical sense. Some of the themes he liked, he was very interested in the down-and-out hero. His heroes are almost always these sort of loser guys. In Double Indemnity, Fred McMurray plays this insurance salesman who gets caught up in murder by his own sort of lust and weaknesses. In The Apartment, Jack Lemmon plays this really weak, wussy character. Sunset Boulevard, right? I mean, the main character starts off narrating the story as he lies dead in a swimming pool. And when we flash back to the very beginning of the story, he's not in a much better situation. You know, he's still, like, on the run from creditors and that kind of stuff, you know?
Again, a similar theme with The Fortune Cookie, which is a very lightweight comedy, but it's about a cameraman who gets injured by a football player as he's shooting the game. And so we have another situation where an admirable person has been kind of thrown for a loop. And so that theme runs through not just his more dramatic films, but also the more comedic ones as well.
Yeah, and in that movie, of course, the Jack Lemmon character who plays the cameraman is being bullied around by pretty much everyone else in the film, including his friend and his wife. And they're trying to bully him into doing the wrong thing. And it's funny because you think, you know, oh, today everyone always says we live in such a litigious society. But here's a movie in 1966 sort of addressing that same thing. Like, should you just try and cash in on an injury, even if it's not that bad? You should just try and sue if you can get a big payday. And, of course, we have that same sort of cynical look on life where we expect that people will generally just be selfish and behave in their own wrong interests. And then we should maybe mention Jack Lemmon. He keeps coming up because he collaborated with Wilder a whole lot. The Fortune Cookie, which Sam just mentioned, is one of the Jack Lemmon-Walter Matthau collaborations. It was written and directed by Wilder. Jack Lemmon shows up in The Apartment, Irma LaDuce, just tons and tons of movie constantly showing up. He's in Some Like It Hot. And who plays the sort of down-and-out, lovable loser better than Jack Lemmon? I don't think anyone does. And so obviously it makes sense why he would keep working with him. Wilder also directed two of the most famous Marilyn Monroe movies, The 7-Year Itch and Some Like It Hot, both sort of screwball comedies. And interestingly, while I think Wilder generally liked strong women, he didn't ever really cast Marilyn Monroe as a real strong woman. He kind of played to her type as a sort of ditzy blonde. But it's interesting, in both of the Monroe movies, she's not like the total prototypical ditzy blonde. She's sort of a woman who's kind of self-assured.
And, yeah, he's not condescending about it.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And if you look at a movie like, again, Double Indemnity, you see in that movie, Barbara Stanwyck is pretty much the definition of the femme fatale, one who knows what she wants and is going to get it regardless of the consequences. And that's something you don't see a whole lot of in movies from that era. It is not, you know, strong female characters have, you know, to an extent, always been around. They're always movies. But I think they're the exceptions rather than the rule back in those times. And so Wilder, sort of ahead of his time and really portraying women in generally speaking, strong roles. He also has lots of interesting takes on romance. You know, his romantic movies are rarely the normal sorts of romances, even for screwball comedies. I think he often likes interesting, strange romances. The romance in Double Indemnity leads to murder, and same sort of thing in Sunset Boulevard, in fact, and The Apartment's romance between Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine, which ends with them playing cards rather than embracing, is an interesting take on romance. Again, we see that sort of cynical, but not quite too jaded, that it's nihilistic view that Wilder constantly has.
I also think it's worth mentioning in 1, 2, 3, the romance there is very peripheral, but it's interesting how it's used just as the basis for the conflict. It takes this one romance that crosses the boundaries and uses that as the spark that causes this furor. In this case, a commercial and political clash between the East and West in Berlin.
Yeah, he likes to make movies sort of that are maybe about topical themes that work with it. And again, always pushing the envelope. So 1, 2, 3 is a really underrated movie, and I'm sure we'll talk about that next week when we get more into Wilder's films. So we hope to kind of give you an idea of Wilder. And if you're interested in checking out his filmography, you can really jump in pretty much anywhere. Like we said, you don't see this sort of real progression of style that you do with other directors. I mean, you can start with any one of his movies that just looks good to you. Maybe just go check out his filmography. We'll have a link to his IMDb entry on our website, allmovietalk.com. And just pick a movie that looks interesting to you, maybe one we've talked about. If you want some more specific recommendations, keep it tuned here to All Movie Talk when we go into the films of Billy Wilder next week.
To go along with this week's segment on Billy Wilder, I have a trivia question about him. Billy Wilder's last film was Buddy Buddy in 1981, but in the early 1990s, he considered coming out of retirement to direct one more movie. He even wrote an early draft of the screenplay, but ultimately, he decided he wanted to stay retired, and allegedly he helped convince one of the movie's producers that he should just direct it himself. Of course, the question is, what is the name of this mystery movie? So, we'll come back later on in the show in order to answer this question, so be thinking about it in the meantime. It's time for another installment of Fact or Fiction, where I tell you a few stories about the movie world, and Steven and you folks at home have to guess whether they're true or just plain lies, dirty lies that people tell and become urban legends. The stories I've got for you for this week are all about unnatural deaths. Death is a common theme in urban legends, probably because it unsettles us and makes for stories that stick in our minds. The first story, it's a very famous story about the Wizard of Oz. Dorothy and the Scarecrow have just met up with the Tin Woodsman, and as they march down the yellow brick road into the distance and turn a corner, a strange figure can be seen in the woods in the background. And this figure is actually a stagehand that got caught on camera, but he had hung himself on the set, and the body wasn't discovered until after this scene was shot. Now, Steven, is this story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
It's, I think, pure fiction.
Pure fiction. Of course, this story is false, yes. Some versions of the story, by the way, say that it was one of the actors who played the Munchkins that hung himself, a guy who was just lovesick over a female Munchkin. Either way, it's pretty improbable that you could... I mean, just think about the number of people on a film set. A live film set is crawling with people all the time. People build these sets, people light them, people photograph them, wire them for sound. You can't hang yourself on a live film set and
right.
Not be noticed.
It'd be pretty obvious.
And if by some miracle that had happened, the body would certainly have been discovered later, and there's just no way the shot would remain in the movie once it was discovered. And you'd have the director and the post-production crew, editors, musicians, and stuff all poring over this footage. It just would not go unnoticed at all. What that strange figure in the background really is, though, because there is one, it's a crane, a bird. For that scene, the filmmakers released a number of exotic birds into the set. They were borrowed from the Los Angeles Zoo, peacocks and stuff like that, and they were free to roam around and get picked up on the camera just to add a little color and atmosphere to the movie. The suicide story only dates back to 1989. It doesn't appear earlier than that. And this was the 50th anniversary video re-release of The Wizard of Oz. Until then, it was just rumored to be a stagehand who accidentally got caught on camera just wandering around. But people paused their videos and invented this more dramatic story about it in 89. But it's just a bird. Well, this brings us to another, perhaps equally famous story about something mysterious caught on camera. You see, a long time ago, a boy killed himself in this house with a shotgun, And years later, a film crew used this house to film their movie Three Men and a Baby. Now, in a certain scene of the movie, in the background, you can see a shotgun leaning up against a window behind a curtain. And then in another scene, you can see in the same place behind the curtain, a very clear figure of a boy standing very eerily still. Of course, this boy is the ghost of the boy that killed himself in that house, and the film cameras picked up his image. Steven, is this story, I don't know why I have to ask, but is this story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
Pretty sure it's fiction. Let's get those new cameras that can capture things that aren't real.
Yes, as fun as the story it is, we do not actually see a ghost. What you're seeing is a stand-up cardboard figure for an advertising display. There was this whole subplot in the movie that was originally written about Ted Danson's character doing a dog food commercial, but this subplot was cut. But this cardboard ad display had already been made for it, and it got left on the set. So this image of a boy is actually this little cardboard display. And the rifle is not really a rifle at all, but an optical illusion of how the curtains happen to be draped over the display. The shotgun itself isn't actually that convincing, but when we see the boy later, and it does look eerie, actually, if you see the scene, it's quite eerie. It really is actually kind of a spooky image. But the urban legend about the boy killing himself in that house is totally untrue, and in fact, the house is not a house at all, but a soundstage in Toronto.
Right, and again, I mean, the thing to remember is with these sorts of stories, every frame of film in a movie is poured over dozens and dozens of times. If there's anything weird like that, it wouldn't have made it into the final cut of the movie, generally speaking.
Right, and some people, I think, maybe think that they're less examined than they really are because we come up with bloopers all the time. There's lists and lists out there on the internet of goofs that they made when making the movie, like, oh, in this scene is the tie is not on, and the other scene it is, or whatever. People do notice these before it gets released. The thing is, it's too expensive to go correct the error and not really worth it. So, things like that do get noticed. All right, story number three. During the filming of The Crow, actor Brandon Lee was to perform a scene in which he gets shot by a gun, or shot at, rather. The gun was loaded with blanks, but a fragment of a dummy bullet was lodged in the gun barrel, and when they shot the scene, the blank propelled it out, and it hit Brandon Lee and killed him, gave him a fatal wound in his side. The movie was completed after a rewrite and some tricky editing and special effects, but the shot where Lee actually gets killed remains in the finished film. Now, Steven, is this story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
Oh, man. I know tragically Lee was killed on the set of that film, and I think under those circumstances, but I don't believe they actually used the shot where he died, did they?
You're absolutely right. This was obviously a great tragedy and pretty bitterly ironic given how prematurely and mysteriously his father died. He was Bruce Lee. And that's probably what spurred a number of conspiratorial theories about how Brandon Lee died, because Bruce Lee died under some actually very strange circumstances. But the story as I told it with regard to The Crow was how it happened, except for the part about the footage being used in the finished film. Some sources say this footage was destroyed before it was ever developed. Others say the police had a look at it first. Either way, they weren't going to use this footage in the movie. Now, story number four. The 1956 John Wayne film, The Conqueror, an epic about Genghis Khan, was filmed near a nuclear testing ground site, and radiation that was around the time during the shoot caused about 100 members of the cast and crew to contract cancer, including the top six billed actors. That would be John Wayne, Susan Hayward, Pedro Armendariz, Agnes Moorehead, Thomas Gomez, and John Hoyt, as well as the film's director, Dick Powell, better known for his acting roles. They all contracted cancer and later died from it. So, Stephen, is the story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
I've never heard this story before, but
really?
There's no way that can actually be the case. So, I mean, obviously, I know at least Wayne died of cancer, but
well, unfortunately, this is actually true. There was too much radiation on the set at the time. It wasn't very well understood, but pretty much, a lot of people that were on the set at that time later died from cancer, and Pedro Armendariz killed himself when he discovered he was diagnosed, but clearly that was a related death as well. In many cases, though, the cancer was not contracted until long after the fact. John Wayne, of course, made movies all the way up till his death in 1979 at the age of 72, and this was in 56 when this movie was filmed. The most bitter irony of all is that of all the movies to die for, this has just got to be last on the list. I mean, it stars John Wayne as Genghis Khan, incredibly purple prose delivered in a very laughably pedestrian way. It makes for a great good-bad movie, but definitely not worth giving your life to make. My last story also deals with a large number of deaths associated with a particular production, and that's the Poltergeist trilogy of films made between 1982 and 1988. It's a weird thing. Everybody who has acted in any of these three movies, other than maybe the extras, but certainly the lead cast, they're all dead now, mostly under bizarre circumstances. Most famously, the two girls from the first movie, Dominic Dunn, who played Dana, was strangled by her boyfriend in 1982, and Heather O'Rourke, who plays Carol Ann in all three movies, and utters the memorable line, "They're here," you probably heard that even if you've not seen the movie, but she died at the age of 12 from septic shock, just as the third movie was in post-production, and in one way or another, the other cast members have died since then. It makes you wonder if that's why they never made a Poltergeist 4. Anyway, Stephen, is this story fact, fiction, or a little of both?
Well, I'm pretty sure I just heard Craig T. Nelson's voice in The Incredibles not too long ago, so I don't think he's been killed yet.
Oh, you know, they record the voices for animated features well in advance.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I'm going to have to go with fiction here.
Okay, well, it is fiction. There's Craig T. Nelson. There's Jo Beth Williams. They play the parents. There's also Tom Skerritt and Nancy Allen. They're all still around. But the stories I told about the girls, Dominic Dunn and Heather O'Rourke, are unfortunately true, and two other untimely deaths occurred that contribute to the rumor that this series was cursed. Those would be Julian Beck, he died from cancer, and Will Sampson from complications in surgery. But in both of those cases, the deaths were not unexpected. Their conditions predated their involvement with the movie, so that just started a firestorm of rumors and urban legends and other things that exaggerated the truth. But there's nothing to suggest there's, you know, a curse on the movies or anything like that. Well, a few weeks ago, we had a top six list about movies that play with time, except for time travel movies, and we said, oh, maybe sometime in the future we'll do a time travel top six list. That is this week's top six topic. Why do we do top six instead of top five, Stephen? I think it has something to do with time travel, right?
Well, actually, it turns out that in the future we do top seven, because seven is one more than six, and six becomes the new norm after we become huge international superstars and start ripping off our top six lists. But for right now, we do top six lists because everyone else does top five, and we wanted to go one higher.
I'm looking forward to that day. All right, well, number six. You know, sometimes in my number six slot, I like to use an obscure movie that deserves some maybe more exposure than it gets, or maybe it's just fun to talk about. This week, my number six in this category is The Final Countdown from 1980. It stars Kirk Douglas, and he's on an aircraft carrier. It starts out in modern day, which is 1980, and suddenly this whole aircraft carrier, outfitted with modern aircraft and everything, personnel, gets transported back to 1941 at Pearl Harbor, just a few hours before a key moment in history that you may be able to predict. You know, it sounds sillier than it is. It actually feels like a serious war thriller, despite these fantasy elements, but it has a lot of fun with the idea, and usually in time travel movies, you transport individuals into other times, and what I found interesting about this is it brings a whole group of people, I mean, hundreds of people, and a whole lot of modern technology and tools that can be used to interact with the 1941 world. Very interesting movie.
Does it feature the song The Final Countdown by the great band Europe?
No, but I thought of that when I saw the title for the first time, but no, it doesn't.
That's too bad.
Unfortunately.
Well, my number six movie is a lot less obscure, and it's a childhood favorite of mine. It's Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure from 1989, directed by Stephen Herrick, whoever the heck he is. I'm sure probably most of our listeners are familiar with it. It's just a silly high school comedy from the 80s. It's about these two loser guys who want to form a band. They're barely passing high school, and so in order to pass their history exam, suddenly this guy played by George Carlin appears from the future with a time-traveling phone booth and tells them, you know, the future has sent me back to save you guys because you have to graduate high school so that you guys can form this super band. Your music will save the entire world and unite the world in peace and harmony in the future. And then they have to go back in time and collect famous historical figures, including Napoleon. He's that short, dead French dude. And Abraham Lincoln, Billy the Kid, Socrates, the great Greek philosopher, etc. Bring them all into present-day San Dimas for the most rockin' history report of all time. It sounds silly, and it is, but it's a really fun, sweet movie that's also actually surprisingly clever in the way it uses time travel, specifically at the end where the characters realize that when they're in a sticky situation that, wait a minute, we can get ourselves out of this as soon as we're out of it by using our time machine and leaving our past selves handy items. And I think that's a pretty clever way to play with time that a lot of time travel movies don't. Too often I think the characters in time travel movies seem to forget that they have easy access to time travel. They can always fix anything if they ever need to.
Yeah, that's a good movie, and one I resisted seeing for a long time, because, I don't know, a couple of guys who are total idiots and act stupid, not my thing. But Bill and Ted is, at least the first movie, a lot of fun. For my number five choice, I hadn't realized it before, but both of my favorite Star Trek movies are about time travel. They are Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, and Star Trek First Contact. The former stars the original crew and is an absolutely wonderful light adventure comedy. The second has The Next Generation and makes a great suspenseful action thriller. Unfortunately, it's the only Next Generation movie with any punch to it at all, but it's so good, I think it makes up for the others.
I don't know if it makes up for, Star Trek 7 or 9, but definitely a good movie. I didn't even consider either of those movies. I think definitely my favorite of the entire Star Trek series is 4, The Voyage Home, which is just fun and silly and pretty much kind of a departure from most other Star Trek movies, but
yeah.
definitely a good pick. Both those are very strong movies. Well, my number 5 pick is not at all that light, but it's a great, great action movie in addition to being a time travel movie, and it's 1991's Terminator 2 by James Cameron. Quite possibly the single best pure action movie out there. I think it's a pretty close call between a couple other films, but I like it because the first Terminator movie, also a time travel movie, and Terminator 2 just complicates the plot further. It's kind of interesting seeing the weird paradoxes that emerge when they try and go and actually stop the invention of the supercomputer that will eventually destroy the Earth, and apparently they aren't that successful, and it's kind of cool. It doesn't really take time travel that seriously, and if you think about it too hard, it makes your head hurt, like a lot of our time travel movies, but so many great, wonderful action scenes and a fantastic performance by Arnold Schwarzenegger, and also by Linda Hamilton as the mother of the son who will someday lead humanity against the machines. There's a really great scene with Hamilton, I think really sets the tone for the whole movie, when she's trying to escape from the mental institution in which she's being held, and she puts a syringe full of bleach up the doctor's neck, and he says something like, I know your profile, you're no killer, and she just responds to him, to me, you're already dead, because of course she believes that humanity is going to be wiped out in a nuclear holocaust in the very near future. Classic action movie and a great time travel flick.
Yeah, and one that I enjoyed really thinking about too, because it certainly wasn't a new idea at the time when these movies came out, but it was the first time I had really been exposed to something different than the Back to the Future kind of thing, where you can, something happens, then you can go back in time and change it. In the Terminator universe, that can't happen. If you go back in time, you can't change something, because whatever you did is already what was required to generate the future that you came from. I don't know, it's a weird
right.
kind of circular paradox kind of deal, but it was the first time I had really been exposed to that kind of time travel mentality. I'm not a huge science fiction reader, I guess, and I just had a whole lot of fun with this other kind of look that time travel had. Plus, of course, it's a great action movie. My number 4 is 12 Monkeys from 1995. It's Terry Gilliam's best film. It's about this convict played by Bruce Willis, and he's sent back in time to figure out why most of the planet has been wiped out. This is a post-apocalyptic future kind of a deal, but along the way there's some astonishing turns of events, and there's a great tone to it. I think Terry Gilliam has a problem with maintaining a coherent and consistent tone in a lot of his movies, but this one is pitch perfect the whole way through, exceptionally well directed, and Steven, I'm sure, will be talking about this a bit more later on in the segment, so let's just jump to the next movie.
Yeah, why don't we? Because I am going to talk about it a bit later. My number 4 flick is something that I'm sure is on your list somewhere, and that's the original Back to the Future from 1985, directed by Robert Zemeckis. How much do I really even need to say about it? It's great, it's fun, it plays with time in a pretty clever and straightforward way, and it's just such a wonderful comedy. We have the whole fish out of water stuff with Marty McFly, back, stuck from 1985 back to the 1950s, and having to deal with his parents and seeing. I think it's fun the way that he learns that his parents aren't the way he would have thought they were when they were kids, and just a lot of great stuff, and a great, great supporting role by Christopher Lloyd as Doc Brown.
Yeah, and this, of course, if we remember several weeks ago in our Best of the Year series, this is my favorite movie of 1985. It's one of these popcorn blockbuster kinds of things that were really popular in the 80s, that still holds up. This one really is a great movie. It wasn't just a passing fad. It's definitely very light, and I think people will mistake that for being something superficial if you don't really think about it, but really this is an extremely well-put-together movie. Well, for number three, another one that I think is deceptively simple, because it was never supposed to be great, certainly didn't look like it was going to be great, maybe it looked like it was going to be fun but disposable, but it is Groundhog Day from 1993, starring Bill Murray. It just feels like this gimmick vehicle for, you know, some comic star. Not a huge amount of ambition that we feel here, but definitely in recent years I think people are starting to realize that this is actually a great film. And the premise is pretty simple. It's this grumpy, lazy kind of reporter. He goes to Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania to cover the Groundhog Day festivities, and he does that. And when he wakes up the next morning, it's the same day. He winds up living the same day over and over and over again. And the movie does an absolutely fantastic job at portraying the changing way he deals with this. First, he's panicked and trying to figure out what happened, and then he kind of admits that he's defeated by this cosmic anomaly and just sleepwalks through each day, and then he, you know, gets bored of that and tries to find a way to amuse himself by taking advantage of the situation. You know, he knows all the answers to the Jeopardy show that was on that day, and so on. But it's a weird thing because his actions don't have consequences, and that's not normally the case, you know. So he starts experimenting with doing these outrageous things in spite of obviously bad consequences. But very interesting, very funny, and also a good romance in this, which isn't always the focus of the movie, but certainly at the heart of it.
Absolutely, and I'm going to be talking about this in a few minutes as well, so I'll save my comments for that. Well, my number three movie is Primer from 2004 by Shane Carruth. It's a great little independent film about two friends who invent a time machine in their garage, and they start using it. And the way this time machine works is a little bit different than the way time machines work in a lot of movies. For instance, you have to turn it on, and then you can later use it. So you can't go back indefinitely. You can only go back as far as the very first time that you turn the machine on. And this leads to some interesting and weird consequences as people begin exploiting the way that this works in some unusual and unexpected ways. And there's very clearly defined rules of the way time travel works in this film, which is interesting. And it actually is one of the few time travel movies that works really well, sort of as a puzzle. You can put it together, and I think if you dissect it, it stands up really, really well. It's a very interesting puzzle movie. And it's a very interesting movie about what happens to the relationship between two people when this new power is introduced. These guys have been friends for a long time, and suddenly they have the ability to time travel and change each other's past and change each other's future, and that creates a rift between them that's not easily overcome. I mean, how would you like it if your best friend could go back and erase your last week? That would be kind of an unsettling concept, and this is one that plays with it in a very interesting and intriguing way.
Very intriguing. I'm not convinced it's possible to understand this movie without going on the internet afterwards, but fortunately we do have the internet, and you can do that. Interesting about Primer is that, remember I was talking before, there's the Back to the Future mode of time travel, and there's the Terminator mode of how that works. This is a third way, and one that I had not ever heard of before, and so it's kind of fun to discover how this film uses a totally different set of rules of time travel in a very interesting way. My number two, well, it's Terminator 2, and I'm going to combine it with Terminator 1 as well, because I think these movies work especially well together. 2 is definitely a better film, but they're both two of my favorite action movies from the 80s. I don't think there's anything more to say about it. I do wish, however, that James Cameron would go back to making movies instead of, you know, living underwater or whatever it is he's doing these days.
We should also mention that Terminator 3 is not actually a bad movie, even though you might think it is. It's a decent film. And I kind of like some of the things it does with the chronology of the movies and the way it plays. Particularly the ending of Terminator 3, I think, is pretty clever. The way it brings everything back to the very start of the series is sort of weird, altered, screwed up chronology.
Yeah, I agree. It's inferior, but still a good movie.
Well, my number two flick is something Sam's mentioned already, and it's Groundhog Day from 1993 by director Harold Ramis, and it's just a lot of fun, like Sam said. It's first and foremost a comedy, and it's just hilarious. Bill Murray is at his deadpan best here. I don't know if he's ever given a better sort of pure comedic performance than right here, as he starts off cynical and jaded, goes through such a wide range of emotions. But of course, for Bill Murray, a wide range of emotions means the way his mouth curls changes by a millimeter or two, because he's very good at conveying emotion without actually conveying emotion. And I also think it's fun, you know, Sam, you mentioned that it's about a guy who suddenly has no more consequences for his actions. And for a while, he then, you know, his actions are everything we'd do if there were no consequences. He robs money, he gets women, he does that kind of stuff. And then by the end of the movie, though, that's no longer satisfying him, and he's forced into just doing good deeds, despite the fact that he's not going to even really get rewarded for them, because every day he has to do the same good deeds again. It's an interesting take, saying that if consequences were removed entirely, we couldn't really enjoy the fruits of anything. We would turn, I think, to being good people, because, well, that's the only thing that really gives us any immediate fulfillment and enjoyment, that's ultimately more important to us than these fleeting material possessions. I think this makes it very clear by, you know, anything he does, he only keep for the next 18 hours or whatever.
I'm not sure I actually even agree with that philosophy, but certainly it's fun and intelligent. Rare for a movie of this caliber, this gimmick comedy, like I said before, to try to be intelligent and think about things like this is very unusual. All right, well, my number one has been mentioned before by both of us, and it is Back to the Future, my favorite movie from 1985. It took me by huge surprise at the time. Maybe that's one of the reasons I have a special affinity for it. I admire a lot of movies, but seem to have a special love of the ones that I kind of discovered myself, that weren't discovered for me by critics or whatever. But I remember browsing the movie schedule for the theater on the American military base in Germany we lived near at the time. I lived in Germany during most of the 80s, and I didn't know anything about it. Didn't see any advertising or anything. It's pretty isolated from the normal American culture over there. Some things made it over and some didn't. I didn't know anything about it other than the title and the MPAA rating, which said I could go to it. So, you know, maybe it was marketed to death over here, but anyway, we went over to see it, and my parents and brother and I, and the theater was packed, and we had to split up. All four of us just came out of there marveling at how good it was. We sort of compared notes at the end, and wow, it really struck all four of us as being something really remarkable. I also want to especially mention the sequels. The sequels are both pretty good. They're not as good as the first one, but the second one has far more fun than either of the other two in playing with the time travel idea. You have to see the first, but when you see the second, it just takes the premise of the whole time travel thing and then just has all the more fun with it. It's a very joyous kind of a movie.
Yeah, I think the second one is kind of unfairly maligned because there is a sort of a dark stretch. You know, we see some real consequences to the characters' actions and the idea that playing with time can be really dangerous. But I mean, if you watch one and two just back to back, it's amazing how good of a job number two does in playing with number one's chronology. It's a really interesting experience. And I think if you like the first one, just watch it and then immediately, don't even stop, just put the next DVD in and watch Back to the Future 2. It's great. Well, my number one, also already been mentioned, 12 Monkeys, Terry Gilliam's 1995 masterpiece. And Sam mentioned the tone, which I think is important, but also the story, I think, is this is far and away the best script that Gilliam has ever directed. I think a lot of his problems stem from just problems at the basic story level. But here, everything works perfectly. A lot of stuff is set up wonderfully well. And I like the idea that here the time traveler is specifically told, you can't alter anything. Anything you do in the past has already happened, and you can't change it. And does he change it or doesn't he? It's sort of hard to tell. There are some clues that maybe things have changed in subtle ways, but he's really just back on a reconnaissance mission. And once again, sort of Terminator 2 kind of thing, where the entire world's going to be dead shortly, but he has to go and find this information. And I also like the way that it plays around with, is he crazy or is he time traveling? And how different would the two actually be? How could you really tell? I think that's just interesting. And of course, the wonderful story twists and the last 20 minutes of the film are just so amazing. The first time you see it, all the twists and plot turns coming together. And then when you watch it a second time and you realize how much it's been telling you the whole time that this is going to happen this way, it's really impressive and just fascinating film. Just so intricate and well put together. I think far and away the best movie on my list.
And great acting, too. I should mention Brad Pitt in this.
Yes.
Fantastic performance. And this is what brought him to the public eye, so to speak. And now he's just sort of this icon that a lot of people are annoyed with and others are quite still enamored with. And that's all the more annoying to the other people. But we have to go back. Rewind time. You know, this is all about time travel. Go back to 1995. Brad Pitt turns into this fantastic performance without bringing along any baggage of his stardom. And that's a real great performance. And of course, Bruce Willis is his usual best, I think, there too. All right, so let's recap. Actually, before we recap, I do want to mention The Time Machine from 1960. It's sort of a sentimental movie for me, but I read the book first. You know, that's always a mistake when you go to see the movie, because it never lives up.
Yeah, me too.
The book is fantastic. The 1960 movie is iconic in a way, but just missed my list. Anyway, my number 6 is The Final Countdown from 1980. Number 5, Star Trek IV The Voyage Home from 1986. As well as Star Trek First Contact from 1996, number 4, 12 Monkeys from 1995, number 3, Groundhog Day from 93, number 2, Terminator and Terminator 2 from 84 and 91, and number 1, Back to the Future from 1985.
And my list of top 6 time travel movies: number 6, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure from 1989, number 5, Terminator 2, 1991 by director James Cameron, who is living underwater these days, number 4, the first Back to the Future film with an honorable mention to the second, and the first one, of course, from 1985 by director Robert Zemeckis, number 3, Primer, Shane Carruth's 2004 film, number 2, Groundhog Day, the 1993 flick by Harold Ramey, and the number 1 time travel movie, 12 Monkeys, Terry Gilliam's 1995 magnum opus. On our website, allmovietalk.com, we've been talking a lot about the Rocky movies in the last couple months or so since the release of Rocky Balboa in December. And I wanted to go ahead and go back and look at the start of this series. So I went and watched the original Rocky film on DVD, and I was struck by just how wonderful of a movie it is. So today I want to go ahead and do a spotlight on Rocky. It's a movie probably a lot of you have already seen, but I think it's worth looking at again. And I went through and was just shocked by how I misremembered the film. It's not at all the movie, the sort of cultural icon that we think of it as. The original movie is really a low-budget movie that has sort of an independent spirit and feels like a 1970s movie. It doesn't at all have a lot of spectacle or flash, and in fact, there's not even much boxing in it, which I think might surprise you if you haven't watched it in a while, or if maybe you also couldn't remember the sequels and how different they are in terms of tone and content. So to get started, Rocky is sort of an interesting story behind the movie. It was eventually produced in 1976 and directed by a guy named John G. Avildsen, who really doesn't have a lot of other great credits to his name. I mean, this is the guy who also directed the Karate Kid films. Not exactly a top-notch director, but he does a just really admirable job with the film. In fact, pretty impressive. He won Best Director that year at the Oscars for it. But the movie was written by Sylvester Stallone, based on a fight he watched involving Muhammad Ali, the heavyweight champion who fought an unknown boxer at one point in time. And that unknown boxer was one of the only very few people who actually knocked down Ali during Ali's boxing career. And anyway, Stallone was sort of a struggling actor. He wrote this story, the script, and had to convince the studio and the producers of the film that he wanted to star in it. I think Stallone probably also wanted to direct it, but they weren't going to let him do that. He would go on to direct some of the later films in the series. But he sort of had to convince him that, you know, he should be the guy to star in it. But because there wasn't a big star, the movie had a very small budget. I think it was right around $1 million, which in 1976 wasn't going to buy you a whole lot. So that's why, in part, the movie has sort of a small tone. If you look carefully, you'll notice at the end fight between Rocky and the champ that a lot of the crowd scenes are like stock footage and stuff, doesn't quite fit in because the movie was on a budget. But it's an interesting film because, of course, the story, I'll recap it, probably everyone knows it. Stallone plays a sort of washed-up boxer. He's a guy who never really had a chance at it, never really did anything with his life. He's past 30, so he's a little bit over the prime for a boxer. And he's just fought a bunch of local fights and never really done much. He's working as a sort of enforcer for a local loan shark and lives in this crummy apartment and is sort of interested in this woman who's the sister of his best friend and, you know, can't really get anywhere and just feels like he's kind of a loser. He says at one point, you know, I'm half a bum. And anyway, he ends up getting a chance to fight the current world heavyweight champion as sort of a publicity the stunt when the champion's fight is canceled because his opponent broke his hand. He goes and decides, you know, he'll do an American thing and pick someone at random to fight him. And he picks Rocky because he likes his name. His short name is the Italian Stallion. And it's interesting to look at from a lot of ways. In part, I think it's interesting to look at it as a 1970s movie because I think that this does have a lot to say about America in the 1970s. Rocky is, I think, a quintessentially American story. It's a movie about the underdogs, and if there's one thing that America loves to consider itself always, it's an underdog. And it's also about going the distance. There's a point toward the end of the film where Rocky's training to fight the champion, and he knows he's not going to beat the current world heavyweight champion. Here he is, some, you know, barely professional boxer. And he says, you know, I don't want to win. I just want to go the distance. I want to stay every round. No one's ever gone all the rounds with the champ, with Apollo Creed. I want to be the one who does it. And I think that, you know, if you look at America in the 1970s after, you know, this is just after the Vietnam War, and I think that war certainly influenced America throughout the 70s more than any other single event. It's after Watergate. It's after all these really bad events. The 1970s was sort of a bad decade for America in general. I think this is a movie that became a surprise hit because it touched that tone. It said, look, you don't always have to win at everything you do. Just having heart and wanting to do the right thing and wanting to succeed, that can be enough. That's still worthwhile. I think that was a message that, you know, America kind of needed and wanted to hear.
Yeah, and at that time it was a very needed message, and I think you can get that impression just when you see the you know, the Academy Awards. Rocky won Best Picture against movies that we now think were probably retroactively a little bit better, but, you know, All the President's Men, Network, Taxi Driver, those are the three big heavyweights from the 70s that we think of as really classics from that era. But they're all sort of downers. They're all pretty realistic and cynical, and Rocky is the one that says, okay, well, maybe the world is not, you know, always the place where you can just always come out on top, but you kind of can. You can live the American dream, even if you don't win, like you say. It's a very powerful message, and I think the fact that it took the Best Picture prize is very, very telling from a historical standpoint.
Yeah, definitely. And it was also just a huge box office hit at the same time. Just no one expected it. You know, it's a boxing movie. But it's not really a boxing movie, and I think this is something worth talking about as well. I think we remember it as a boxing movie because the later films certainly, I think, had more fighting in them. Especially by the time you get to, like, Rocky IV, which is nothing but fights and training montages. But the original Rocky movie, there's only really two fights in the film. There's a short one at the beginning and then the one at the end between Rocky and the champ. Otherwise, most of it's sort of a character study. It's about this weird guy from Philadelphia who talks kind of funny and trying to make something somehow and trying to make himself a little bit better. I mean, some of the performances are so strange. Talia Shire as Adrian gives this weird, shy, muted performance, and there's all sorts of wonderful little moments where the two of them are building a relationship together, and, you know, that's kind of something you wouldn't think would be in sort of a modern... If you were to make Rocky today, I don't think it would take the time to do all of that. You know, movies today just don't. And in the 70s, it was much more in fashion to make very character-oriented, little darker films, and here we get it. And the movie also looks like a 70s movie. Avildsen, like I said, not really a distinguished director, but does a very good job here and won the Oscar. It also won Best Editing at that year's Academy Awards and definitely deserves it. The film sort of pioneers the musical montage cliche of today, but at the time that was definitely a lot fresher. And it's also just a well put together and composed film in terms of the way these sequences play out. The two different sort of training montages that go in make a nice job, and the music is also fantastic. Of course, Bill Conti's score, really well remembered today, especially that sort of title song, Gonna Fly Now, that everybody knows. And almost, you know, in a way, the movie kind of reminds me of Raging Bull. The two are really different in terms of overall tone, but they're both boxing movies where the boxing is not at all the important thing. They're both really about the boxers themselves and what it's like to be a boxer. And, you know, Raging Bull is sort of the story of a guy who's more of a success in the ring than Rocky was, but both sort of similar in that sense.
Let's add, if we're going to talk about that category of movies, we could also add Million Dollar Baby into that, another boxing movie that's not really about boxing, but about a boxer.
Yeah.
And I actually don't think this is at all a strange thing. Really, if you take any, you can set a movie against any particular subject matter or world or theme or whatever, and ultimately, probably if it's a good movie, it's not going to be about that thing, whatever it is. It's going to be about the people that are engaged in that activity. And I think a lot of the stronger movies that we have just in general
are the ones that remember to focus on the character and not so much whatever the activity they're engaged in. Because really, it could be boxing, but it could be anything else, and the story would still work.
Right. And then, of course, you also have Rocky IV, which is, like I said, nothing but people hitting each other for
right.
very strange and dubious reasons. Anyway, yeah, but like I said, I think Rocky, if you go back and look at it, really feels fresh. It doesn't feel like a spectacle at all. It feels like a small, independent film, almost, with this really wonderful message, and it's really amazing to me how well made of a film it is. Like I said, it won those three Oscars for a pretty good reason, I think, and you know, by the time that fight begins at the end, and you know, I've seen the movie before, I know exactly how it's going to end, but boy, when that music kicks in as that microphone lowers and the two guys enter into the ring, and as that fight, and the fight itself, should mention, was pretty much choreographed out. You only really see the first couple and the last couple of rounds. There's a sort of a montage that covers the intervening rounds. Obviously, you couldn't film an entire boxing match. But those few matches are just really wonderful examples of how to choreograph movie boxing and movie fighting in general, because everything's so overly dramatic, but it works really well. I mean, the very first round is when Apollo Creed just assumes he's going to knock out Rocky in two or three rounds, no problem. And so he's just kind of playing around, taunting him and showboating it up. And then Rocky lands a huge punch unexpectedly and knocks Creed to the ground. And Creed stands up and he's kind of stunned. And then he gets a great look on his face and he starts then just really coming in and pounding him, trying to, he gets angry. And you just feel the emotion of both fighters. And by the end of the fight, they're just so both beat up. And it's such a big, huge moment when that fight finally ends. And it's just a classic, classic movie moment. So definitely worth watching if you haven't seen it in a while, because it's just so surprising to me how interesting and how special this movie is. It really is a movie that's, in and of itself, though it pioneered a lot of cliches and though the movie series would kind of become a giant cliche as it goes on, the original is something very special and wonderful.
To remind everyone of the trivia question asked earlier in the show, it was to name the early 1990s movie that Billy Wilder wrote an early draft of the screenplay for and almost came out of retirement to direct. Got a guess on this one, Stephen, or maybe you didn't know it?
Yeah, my guess is Sabrina from 1995 with Harrison Ford.
Oh, that's a good one, because, of course, Sabrina is a remake of the Billy Wilder movie. He's going to pull a Hitchcock remaking his own movie. Well, it wasn't that. The answer is actually Schindler's List.
Oh, I knew that, yeah. Ah, I heard that before.
Okay. Yeah, you asked me one a few episodes ago where I knew it after you told me. But anyway, Schindler's List, of course, is a great film. I think probably the greatest film of the 1990s for me. Ultimately directed, of course, by Steven Spielberg. But I just can't help wonder what a Billy Wilder version of that story would have been like. Clearly, it would have been very different. Wilder said if he would have done it, it would have been his most personal film. And for that matter, there were a number of other directors that were either offered the job and turned it down or were actually attached to direct for a time. Martin Scorsese was asked to direct, but he thought it should be really a Jewish director who should make it, so he turned it down and instead directed Cape Fear, which originally Spielberg was going to do, so they swapped movies. Sidney Lumet was attached to direct for a while. Roman Polanski was asked to direct it, but he didn't think he was ready to take on the Holocaust, because of course he was quite a victim of it in his own life. Later, he would make The Pianist on that subject. But what an interesting thing a Scorsese version of Schindler's List would have been, or a Lumet version, or a Polanski version. But I think a Billy Wilder version is the one I can least conceive of in my head. It definitely would have been interesting.
Yeah, you know, that would have been interesting. I can't imagine it either, but maybe it's for the best if you think about it. I don't know how fresh Wilder would have been in the early 90s. And that's about it for this week's show. Unfortunately, that's all we have for you. But if you want even more than the weekly episodes, you can go to our website at allmovietalk.com. If you know the name of the show, All Movie Talk, you know the name of the website, allmovietalk.com, where we'll have a lot of great discussion for you, including reviews of new releases, discussion about great movies in the past, and tons of comments about each week's episode. So check there for more action.
And also check out rinkworks.com, RINKWORKS.COM spells rinkworks.com, and it's the location of a bunch of great entertainment features, including a number relating to movies. Next week, of course, we'll have another episode. It'll be episode 24. Coincidentally enough, that's one more than this week's episode 23, but we're going to answer some pretty weird questions for you, like maybe you want to know how to win the girl. You find yourself in a romantic comedy and you just don't know. Well, we'll tell you that. And also, what if your chin
could kill people. We'll be examining that topic very carefully next week as well. And of course, our top six list for next week. We'd like to give you the topic in advance so you could think about what maybe your choices would be before you get to hear about ours. But it's going to be about plane movies, airplanes, any kind of a movie that takes place on an airplane or involves airplanes. That's the kind of movie we'll be considering for these lists next week. So think about what your favorite plane movies are, and we'll get to all of that and more next week. Cut! Wow, what a great episode. I should travel back in time and tell Steven.